and this is broadcast number 649, May the 14th, 1984. This time last week, I was talking about a secret intelligence group in the Pentagon called the Monarch Eagle that was formed for the special forces, patterned after Nazi Germany and set up by Germans who were let out of prison by John J. McCloy and the powers that be, and formed the Green Berets and this special group. They train at Fort Bragg, South Carolina. The courts were sealing up the DeLorean data, and I have a lot to update you on the trial. Down in Los Angeles, DeLorean isn't on trial. The FBI is on trial. They can't afford to let the information on DeLorean, his money, his counterintelligence activity, his links with drugs and Swiss banks, to come out in the open. So up till now, week two or three of the trial, it's only the FBI on trial and not John DeLorean. Then the bulk of the program last year was on Chester Davis, the lawyer who died just a year ago, one of the most important men of American history, associate of Howard Hughes, never saw Howard Hughes, but helped run the empire after the mysterious Hughes had been shipped from the Beverly Hills Hotel to a hospital in Boston. I was watching last night on television before I went to bed the magic show of Doug Henning and some of his mysterious sawing people in half and large objects that disappear or compressing people into the shape of a disc. There's a Howard Hughes disc somewhere. The biggest magic show going is not Doug Henning, but the Howard Hughes empire that was cut down, compressed, and put on a shelf as a disc. And the inventor, the pilot, the genius who had the tool bit his father invented for drilling oil, had the biggest disappearing act of American history or world history, or one of them, is pretty good competition, and went from Boston and then was never seen again, even by Robert Mayhew in Las Vegas. And he took a hunk of money they got him to sell, or the body sold, or the double sold, or the brain connived, the person who took out his brains. They arranged the sale of the TWA, and then this team of magicians, because they did it in front of our eyes, took these hunks of millions of dollars of cash, I mean $535 million of cash, and went to Vegas and started to buy up the five hotels and casinos. Now, Paul Laxalt was the governor of Las Vegas. He runs the GOP fundraising. He's a senator. Imagine walking in with $535,000 worth of cash and buying these places and never seeing the man who put the money down, and not a trace that he existed in the hotel. That is such a great story, the Howard Hughes story. And there's a writer from London who's in L.A. that wants information on the Hughes story. I said, I don't have the time to go over it with you. I have every book on Hughes that has been published so far and as many articles as I could ever get, four full filing drawers plus more. It is the saga of America. What happens to a genuine person born into a prominent family, third generation, Harvard educated, brilliant inventor, father, imaginative person who worked in test flew airplanes for the United States government, who can be abducted so his empire becomes the umbrella. I use the term for the Nazification of America, and because it's a private empire, we can't get our sticky fingers on it. Well, big story, of course, this week was the Soviet Union not coming to the Olympic Games. I brought up the subject several times on this broadcast, many times, and the most recent broadcast was April 23rd. That was number 646, if you want to order those back tapes. I gave examples of huge newspaper stories, not little articles, but full half pages or three-quarter pages, one from the Los Angeles Times, defections, a touchy matter for the Olympics, how they were going to encourage the people to defect, not only the athletes, but their trainers. Another large story in the Los Angeles Herald, anti-Soviets vow that protests will be a major Olympic event with all the violence of the CARP group, the Reverend Moon group, the Alpha 66 formed by our CIA, and the anti-Castro Cubans. Another large article in the Washington Post, group set safety net to snatch defectors. That's the Young Americans for Freedom, the political right, the group involved with the Munich massacre in 1972. Another large story, the Soviet newspaper alleges Olympic kidnap schemes. There was so much on the Olympic Games, and in that same broadcast, on April 23rd, I talked about Jay Paul of the Los Angeles Police Department passing data and information to Western Goals, that's the John Birch Society, that's the military, it links to the Galen Nazi group in Europe and Austria, and how Jay Paul was working with terrorists in the United States who would, in fact, be in Los Angeles for the Olympic Games, and how the Public Disorder Information Division of the Police Department went from that department to the Anti-Terrorist Division so that all elements of the radical right, the military might, linked to Admiral Edward Teller, the hydrogen bomb, Admiral Moore, the Joint Chief of Staff, former Joint Chief of Staff, and the who's who of the Nazis, and Mr. John Singh Laub of the World Anti-Communist League, all the elements of the CIA, the Defense Department of Navy Intelligence, not the street people. The argument of having the Soviet Union come and change their mind is that we have freedom of speech in America, and these dissident groups can be on the street talking. This comes from the top down, from the National Security Council, from the White House, from the top agencies of CIA, Navy Intelligence, Defense Department. If May Brussel can figure that out, certainly the Soviet Union did. Now, Dianne Feinstein had a comment in the paper this week that there should be no defection. See, that was the problem, was advertising that we're going to let them defect. And she said in San Francisco, and I was interested in what she said because the Democratic conventions will be up there, she said the Olympics is not intended to be for a political thing, and that those officials, in quotes, could not ignore the dangerous conditions for Soviet athletes, that we should never allow defections, that anyone who tries it should be arrested, instead of the Los Angeles Times and Herald advertising that they're supplying and supporting safe houses for the defections. One article in the San Francisco Chronicle referred to, many of you have seen these quotations, that the United States is undermining the Olympics with political maneuvers. Another story from the Soviet Union that they were setting up committees with safe houses and encouraging defections of the Soviet Eastern Europe. Now, Mr. Uberoth, who I wouldn't trust at all, Peter Uberoth, who was in charge of the official Olympic Committee, tried sour grapes to say that now we're paying the price for Jimmy Carter's decision in 1980 not to send the United States Olympic team to Moscow. If Jimmy Carter made that decision in 1980, it was the responsibility of the American Olympic Committee in 1984 to say, look, we understand how you felt then, and since then we took the whole country of Grenada and we've spent billions of dollars in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala, and now we're funding Costa Rica. We want to own all of Central America. If you take the Balkans, Afghanistan's on your border, hey, we understand how you feel, because 4 years later, we're having the same thing on our border. So tit for tat, let's be fair, we're not any worse off now having those people on our border than you were off 4 years ago when you were forced to go into Afghanistan with the CIA stations there. It's disgusting to say that they just were waiting to get even and not go into the reasons that some people are mentioning, the blatant effort to body snatch, the trainers and the athletes. Now, Daryl Gates had an article in the LA Herald and San Jose Mercury. The Soviets had a chance to plan the security. I don't swear on the air, so I'll just say BS. That's absolutely ridiculous. That's like saying that the Secret Service had a chance to protect John Kennedy in Dallas. Hell, you can kill a president, right, going down the street with a Secret Service drunk all in the night before, and with what they did, the FBI and the CIA and the Secret Service and the Army intelligence and the Navy intelligence in covering up the murder of John Kennedy right in our own country with our own president. He's only president 1,000 days. How could the Soviets plan security for so many people in a city the size of Los Angeles with all the nuts that are around there? Now, David Balsagar prided himself that a small group of people could make the big giant fade away. He says, we anticipated 100 or 200 defections, and it does our heart good to think how much control we had over the mighty Soviet Union that they pulled away. But the whole point is that David Wayne Balsiger isn't a small group. He isn't a handful of people. He may have had petitions where he wanted a million names, he only had 10,000. But you only need five. If you have five people, you could change the course of history. If you just had bullets in the brains of five different people, you could control the world. And he says the world's largest superpower buckled under these issues because the United States government won't muzzle us. He isn't the problem. His problem is, where does he work for the space scientists, for the people down in the Los Angeles area? What is the Anaheim, the Smith, Donald S. Smith Associates, the advertising agencies, the high-tech firms? This guy has inroads into the bowels of the government, of the intelligence system, of the counterintelligence system, of the Defense Department. That's like saying with Western Goals and Jay Paul there that there's no danger to Los Angeles or people in the world because information went from the LAPD into a computer in Alexandria, Virginia. It wasn't a computer in Virginia. It was people with computers in Berlin, in Vienna, in Taiwan, in South Korea. Once the information, hundreds of thousands of documents that were supposed to be destroyed, get into the computer, then it goes to every police department around the country. So the argument that, look what we did and we're a few, is ridiculous. This guy has been working with the police department and pulling this all along. Now, the origins of all this didn't just begin yesterday. In some way, before we blow ourselves to smithereens, we have to have a little honesty about where these problems evolved. There's several books I might turn you on to. One is called The Ignorant Armies by E.M. Halliday. It was published by Harper in 1958. And this is the use of American armies that were sent with Britain to make war against Russia when they had the revolution. The Americans had a revolution that we celebrate in the 4th of July, and we're so proud of having our independence from this oppression. The French had the revolution, they celebrate getting rid of the monarchy and having a constitution independence. When the Russians got rid of the Tsar and the pogroms and the horrible police of Russia and had a revolution, Britain and the United States had armies right on the border from 1918-1919. Now, in 1905, maybe you saw the movies on TV of Sidney Reilly. He worked with the Japanese as an agent from Great Britain to bomb the entire Russian fleet. He burned all his friends at the same time and destroyed the Russian fleet in 1905 because Great Britain wanted to control the seas. Bombay, Ceylon, Singapore, China, the narcotics traffic, the tea, the diamonds, India. They didn't want to compete, the oil traffics or anything else, with Russia. So England and Japan were attacking Russia when the Tsar was there. It has nothing to do with communism. There would be a war if the Tsar was still in power. We'd have the same amount of wars because people like to control territory. The French had theirs, the Spanish had theirs, the British had theirs. Japan's a small island. It can identify with England. Russia was big. So those two got together with people like Reilly and bombed Russia in 1905. And when the revolution came and the people brought in the Bolsheviks and communism, that was a worse threat to monarchies and empires like the emperors of Japan or the monarchy of Great Britain with their cousins on every throne of Europe. So the problem began then. And when Nikita Khrushchev was in Los Angeles in 1959, he reminded the people at the banquet he was at of the days when America sent soldiers to their revolution to stop their oppression. Mr. Halliday also wrote an article in 1958 for American Heritage. If you want to look it up in the library, it's called Where Ignorant Armies Clash by Night. And it is the use of American troops at that point with Herbert Hoover, who owned all those millions of dollars of oil and mineral and forests in Russia, to get that government out so that his personal profit would be back in his pocket. And if he couldn't do it alone, he would begin arming our tax dollars, like the $55 million that he sent, that Congress made note of, to overthrow the country. So the war that we're having isn't just a war against an Antichrist. It isn't even a war necessarily because of labor and management or what Marx dreamt of. The war began in 1905 with Sidney Reilly and Japan, and it will continue until the small islands who are dependent upon trade learn that they have to live with land masses that are a bit larger. And America is a land mass who has to allow Grenada or Nicaragua to live without a Somoza family. We have to some way assure the little people that we will trade and help them instead of giving them weapons to kill each other, and then we come in and sweep it up. So these problems of wars began a long time ago, and the reaction to the Olympic Games is perfectly logical of the Soviet Union, but it comes from years of history and experience with what America is capable of doing. Now, there was an article in the Houston Post about questionnaires for the security of the Olympic Games. The Olympic security guards are hired, most of them, by a company called California Plant Protection. There's three companies hiring the guards for the Olympics, and Dr. Arthur LeBlanc, L-E, then a capital B-L-A-N-C, is a consulting psychologist for this firm that has questionnaires on employment. And these were some of the questions for working security at the Olympic Games. I'll read you five of them, or six. One, these are true or false. Everything is turning out just like the prophets in the Bible said it would. I believe in the second coming of Christ. I believe in life hereafter. I believe there is a devil and a hell and an afterlife. I believe there is a God. Now, the Anti-Defamation League asked them to delete these questions from the psychological screening. So if you prefer not to answer them, that means that it isn't yes on all of those. So you must be an antichrist. So you can't be a guard at the Olympic security system. This is set up in Los Angeles. These are the kind of questions that the California Plant Protection, it's called, similar to the Wackenhut Corporation, asked. They've been asking this for 15 years. Now, the Vicky Morgan tapes are in the newspaper again. There was a story during the week and two today, one from the San Jose Mercury. The lawyers asked the government to hand over any sex tapes showing Edwin Meese. You remember when, now Edwin Meese is nominated for the Attorney General, and you remember when Vicky Morgan had her head smashed open with a baseball bat, the mistress of Alfred Bloomingdale, and we've done many broadcasts on this, so I don't have to go backwards. If ever you want it, you can get the broadcast. We'll go further. Marvin Pancos is being charged with the murder of Vicky Morgan. He claims that there are no fingerprints, no proof that he did kill her, but there was another person in the closet when she was killed, and that other person took the tapes that were at the house. And the lawyer for Pancos, this Arthur Barron, has subpoenaed those tapes because he claims this would be explain the motive for cracking her skull open. So he has subpoenaed the FBI and the CIA for sex tapes of Edwin Meese or other government officials that might appear on the tapes. And the attorney for Edwin Meese, Mr. Leonard Garman of Watergate fame, said, "I think it's absolutely outrageous to print this story. Not the fact that it happened, but the fact that it was printed." The subpoena is filed for defendant Marvin Pancos. He wants, in quotes, all documents, audio tapes, videotapes depicting or relating to Vicky Morgan and presidential advisor Edwin Meese or any other government official presently employed on the White House staff or any U.S. senator or congressman. And these have been the individuals cited in the subpoena for the trial of Pancos include Betsy Bloomingdale and a Gordon Basichis, B-A-S-I-C-H-I-S, a writer who was a close friend of Vicky Morgan. Then there was another story in the news just today. Lawyers asked the government to hand over sex tapes showing, that was the one I just did. I have three of them, and that was the one I just gave to you. Lawyers' sex tape case may erupt again. That's the next tape. The Vicky Morgan sex tapes, controversy and allegations of the Reagan administration officials that they were present at orgies is going to surface at the trial of Marvin Pancos. The defense attorney said that Pancos told them he saw the tapes. Remember? These are the tapes that weren't supposed to exist. And the article says that Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flint fueled the controversy when he said he had copies of the tapes. Now, in order to show the motive for her death, they have subpoenaed these tapes. Now, Larry Flint could produce these tapes or tell where they went to show the motive for incarcerating him in a federal mental hospital all this time and for drugging him similar to what they did to Howard Hughes and a lot of other people, and taking his mind away and putting him into a federal pen and causing him almost to lose the empire that he had built up. Now, these tapes, Marvin Panko says, exist. He says that high government officials shown on the videotapes were visiting Vicki Morgan in her North Hollywood condominium, where she was killed the month before her death. High government officials were enjoying the pleasure of Vicki Morgan's body, and that the tapes do in fact exist, and the name of one official, presidential counsel and attorney general nominee Edwin Meese, surfaced during the pre-trial motions. And they want other White House or government officials who were at the sex parties. And then it goes on that Bloomingdale from Ronald Reagan's kitchen cabinet has been investigated by the Los Angeles police for ties to prostitution. That's one story. And then another one this week in Time magazine, I understand Don Fried told me that Time is ready to roll with the Vicki Morgan, Edwin Meese tapes. Time, this magazine, has a story about Alfred Bloomingdale, how he wanted to be the ambassador to France, I guess at the same time that Mr. Annenberg was the ambassador to London. And, oh my goodness, this high society I've been talking about for years, it goes on and on. Bloomingdale could not be ambassador to France because of his long association with Vicki Morgan, his 12-year affair. And then it said his name came up in connection with FBI files in the 1960s and with connections to organized crime. That'll be in Time this week. And he paid $5,000 in blackmail. That was pretty cheap in those days, 15 years ago, because of his habit of beating up prostitutes. For $5,000, he could shut them up. But then the article goes on to say that he was chosen by Ronald Reagan as an appointee for the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board in 1981. Remember the high society and Nancy's borrowed diamonds from Winston and her satin dresses and white gloves and her very best friend, Betsy, and the prostitutes at the house and the whipping and the chains and the sex parties and the government officials. Well, you'll be hearing more of that in the time to come. Now, a few items on the sex, going away from the sex and to Dallas, Texas conspiracy that is always in the back of my mind, because I claim that when John Kennedy was murdered in Texas, the power shifted from Washington and New York to Houston and to Texas because they held the blackmail on the federal government, the CIA, the FBI, Navy intelligence on the murder of John Kennedy. And therefore, the building up of the empire of the banking industry in Houston, the spies, the espionage, would revert back to Dallas where the scene of the crime was, because the power is in the information. If we had tried these people for murdering or for covering up murder, which should be done, the power may have a better balance. But whoever knows the dirty tricks controls the power in this country. Now, there were four articles of major importance this week in the paper. One, again, from the Houston Post, computer to aid U.S. in tracking foreigners. In Dallas, Texas, the computer will be built that will control all U.S. ports of entry and, of course, exit. They'll keep track of everybody entering the United States. It was made, this computer, to spot terrorists, smugglers, especially during the Olympic Games and the World's Fair in New Orleans. They will have access immediately to 22 million people. Well, how fast can you add more names to the computer? It'll start with 22 million names, and they decided that this new center for everybody entering and exiting the United States will allow officials to enter the name and origin of any suspicious person at any ports of entry, and within seconds, the Dallas Center will give the information needed. That means that every passport that day or night, every city, passport, oh, you're going to Tokyo, okay, into the computer. Oh, passport to Philippines, okay. And they'll do more on that in the LAPD and the flights in a second. But the center for entering and exiting the United States, every airline, is now in Dallas, Texas. Now, a small item from the Houston Post, many of you, I don't know if you saw it, I didn't see it in my other papers here, and my friend in Houston sends me a big envelope of articles every week, once a week. Services are set Monday for John Will Fritz, Captain Fritz, of the Dallas Police Department, the investigator who interrogated Lee Harvey Oswald after the assassination of John Kennedy. He was 87. Okay, let's not say he was murdered, a primary witness. I'll give you a natural death at 87, Captain Will Fritz, one of the most important people of American history, who, like Joseph Mengele's or Bormann, lived out his time till nice ripe old age. I described several sentences, in essence, Will Fritz with Lee Harvey Oswald when I wrote a section for The People's Almanac, number 2. It was published by David Walensky and Irving Wallace, his father. And on page 41, I was doing a chronological order of everything that Oswald said they asked me to do from the moment Kennedy was killed until Oswald was killed. And on page 48 of the Almanac, The People's Almanac, number 2, 4:45 to 6:30 p.m. on Friday, November 22nd, Lee Harvey Oswald is in the office of Captain Will Fritz, the gentleman who died this week. And Sheriff Craig is in there, the sheriff, who saw Lee Harvey Oswald enter a white station wagon 15 minutes after the assassination. And in the conversation, Oswald confirms in front of Captain Fritz that he was the person that got into the station wagon. There was a man impersonating Oswald in Dallas. There were a lot of them. One that got into the taxi, the bus first, then the cab, and later then the rooming house. But Oswald could have been taken from the cab to the rooming house. But the point is, what he said to Will Fritz, who's now dead, was, that station wagon belongs to Mrs. Ruth Payne. Don't try to tie her into this. She had nothing to do with it. I told you people, I did. Everybody will know who I am now. That is one of the most important sentences of the entire 26 volumes of the Warren Commission hearings, because I, of all the researchers, have over 230 books on the Kennedy assassination, questioning the Warren Report, and I've never been able to get a single researcher in the United States to help me tell people, other than, say, my radio program or my writing, what it means. Everybody will know who I am now. Now, Ruth Payne was married and is, or I think he passed away, Michael Payne, but was married at the time, to Michael Payne, a third-generation Harvard physicist who worked at Bell Helicopter under General Dornberger, the Nazi war criminal who was supposed to be hung at Nuremberg. General Dornberger ran Bell Aerospace, and Payne worked for him, and Oswald and Marina stayed at their home. And he did get, Oswald said, I got into the white station wagon. And that was the interesting connection, because the doubles in the cab and in the bus were not Lee Harvey Oswald. The one at the rooming house with Earlene Roberts was. He took the white station wagon and went back to the rooming house and got a gun, but he didn't kill Officer Tippett. But, okay, this chief of police is Will Fritz, is long, he's gone now to the great beyond, and Ruth Payne one of these days will expire, and that will be the end of that story. We're losing all the traces of this story. Now, along with Texas, with the power of Houston, Dallas, and Austin, Texas, University of Texas reveals a $32 million endowment. I was worried about the mysterious $8 million that wasn't named. They now exceed, the endowment faculty puts it way ahead of universities, including Harvard University. They're going to study biology, chemistry, computer engineering, microelectronics, all science, all engineering. A hunk of the money comes from the Sid Richardson Foundation, the Oil People of Dallas with the connections to John Connolly, the Cullen Trust for Higher Education, the Welch Foundation. I don't know if that's the Welch of the John Bird Society. I thought he was from New England, and the University of Texas Engineering Foundation. They have come up just recently with $32 million endowment. But another article from the Houston Post said the endowment will help the University of Texas complete its commitment to Microelectronics and Computer Technology Corporation, an international computer brain trust, located in Austin last year. They will share the University of Texas premises, shared facilities, and research. This is University of Texas, $32 million endowment just last month that poured in, and it will help them with the microelectronic international computer brain. Now, also just April 16th, this last month, Microelectronic Computer Technology, that's the one affiliated with this new $32 million, is run by Bobby Inman. We've talked about him before, and I was worried about that, in Austin, Texas, a staff of 110 scientists. It is a combine, privately owned. A hunk of money was put in. Bobby Inman was deputy director of the CIA, director of the National Security Agency, head of Task Force 157 with Henry Kissinger and Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple and Robert Keith Gray. He moved to Austin, Texas, and set up as a private company like the Hughes Organization, the major computer companies of the entire world like Rockwell and Sperry, BMC, the Control Data, Honeywell, the digital equipment. They got a hunk of millions of dollars. So it's not only engineering and the technology that is available. I call it the Electronic Odessa. It's going to be in Austin. It'll work, and they will grab the best scientists, the best engineers, the best people who can pass those tests, like the security people for the Olympic Games. They will have a team from the CIA privately endowed for anything they want to do with it. We'll take a 1-minute break and go on to a little more hairy and scary news.